Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we review issues surrounding important state crimes against democracy in the United States, from the JFK assassination, COINTELPRO, to 9/11 and beyond. Please stay with us for the hour as we talk about real conspiracies in the United States. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we'll be discussing several important and key events in U.S. history that we call state crimes against democracy. These are oft referred to as conspiracy theories or topics that are so controversial where the government has a history of trying to dissuade people from investigating them a priori, that meaning before anyone really investigates these. But what happens when we really do investigate these state crimes against democracy and we look for transparently sourced facts about things like the assassination of JFK, COINTELPRO, 9/11, state surveillance? What we find is there really is a dark, shadowy part of our world and that our free society may not always be as free as we think. Peter, let's talk a little bit about conspiracy theory in America. That's, of course, the title of a book by Lance DeHaven Smith. Also, recently, you were looking at a book called Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy from World War I to 9/11, a book by historian Catherine Olmsted. Later in the hour, we're going to be playing some clips from our JFK assassination special from the 50th anniversary. We'll also be sharing clips from an audio documentary from 1989 titled Me and My Shadow, about surveillance and the federal government spying on U.S. citizens. Again, it's very timely. It was done in 1989, but it could have been done today. We'll round out the show with some clips on our 10th anniversary program about 9/11, specifically looking at problems with the 9/11 Commission. But Peter, let's talk a little bit about conspiracy theory, conspiracy theories in America, and conspiracy realities, because you teach a course called Sociology of Conspiracy.
Well, Catherine Olmsted's book, Real Enemies, is quite telling. She describes how government officials promote certain conspiracy theories, deep, pervasive fears of hidden plotters. They want to, you know, maintain the power to construct conspiracy theories themselves. Terrorists in the world, communists are out to get us, anarchists are bad. But they also want to squash any others or people that come forward with kind of conspiracy theories that are understood. Conspiracies are believed by all groups of people. There's no difference between rich or poor, or there's no difference in race. Elites are just as likely to have conspiracy theories as are working people or middle class. A lot of times people have understandings about how they think about how the world works. But in reality, we're talking about state crimes against democracy and an increasing national security state here in the U.S. and repression and loss of civil liberties. That's been with us for a long time. But some of the early conspiracy theories goes back right to World War I and even before. But certainly for World War I, there are many people in the country that really believe the war was promoted through President Wilson as a way of bailing out the Morgan Bank and the banks in the U.S., which had loaned $3 billion to Britain, to England. In addition, the DuPonts were very interested in having war, because they made a huge amounts of money off of selling munitions during World War I. In fact, they paid their stockholders 2,000% of the value of their stocks during World War I. So there was some real money to be made, and many people in the 20s and 30s understood that and really believed that.
Well, war profiteering is then a plan. It is a conspiracy of sorts. We certainly saw that also in the Iraq War after 2003, where the stock values from Halliburton and other companies connected formerly with Dick Cheney, their stocks went up 300%. So war profiteering certainly is one of these hidden motives, something that's not out for public purview. But when people start really investigating these and people start looking into the factual history, we basically see that there aren't just conspiracy theories per se, but there are also conspiracy realities. And our culture in the United States, the way that conspiracies are off-treated is that if you suggest this type of possibility, you're seen as a tinfoil hat-wearing crackpot or a lunatic, something, you know, these kind of
sometimes
titles.
Sometimes it's presented as a form of mental illness.
Exactly. Like you're just paranoid, right? You have this kind of a a problem. But this is pervasive even in our intellectual culture. Even though this seems to be a more anti-intellectual behavior, labeling and dismissing information about controversial topics, Andy Lee Roth and I wrote in Censored 2014. We were surprised to read in the past year that the New York Times, well, maybe we shouldn't have been surprised, but in the New York Times, there was an article about how conspiracy theories and those who advocate them are to blame for a lot of the cynicism about politics and things of that nature. In an article titled, "Sure, You Saw a Flying Saucer," Maggie Korth Baker drew on psychological research to show those who believe in conspiracy theories are, quote, more likely to be cynical about the world in general and politics in particular. She went on to continue and comment, "Conspiracy theories also seem to be more compelling to those with low self-worth, especially with regard to their sense of agency in the world at large. Conspiracy theories appear to be a way of reacting to uncertainty and powerlessness." That's the end of the quote. But from this perspective, the problem is that although conspiracy theories give believers a feeling of being in control, they don't actually confer greater control. Quote, again, from Kurth Baker from the article, "Psychologists aren't sure whether powerlessness causes conspiracy theories or vice versa. Either way, the current scientific thinking suggests these beliefs are nothing more than an extreme form of cynicism, a turning away from politics and traditional media." Well, at the risk of identifying ourselves at Project Censored as suffering from low self-worth or powerlessness, we note that by emphasizing psychological rather than sociological or historical understandings of conspiracy theories, which is what Peter and I are talking about here, Kurth Baker offers at best a partial understanding of the links between conspiracy theories and political cynicism. Catherine Olmsted, the historian from University of California, Davis, author of the book I mentioned earlier, Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theorists in American Democracy, World War I to 9/11. Catherine Olmsted provides useful counterpoint to Kurth Baker and the predominating low self-worth explanation. And Kurth Baker really paraphrases Olmsted rather than quoting her directly, because Olmsted goes on to say the conspiracy theories wouldn't exist in a world in which real conspiracies didn't exist. And we know that there are real matter-of-fact conspiracies.
Iran-Contra, Watergate, all of these things were conspiracies. They were what we call state crimes against democracy, where people organized. They were inside government, or they were inside private bureaucracies or private companies, and they, in fact, engage in activities that are illegal. That's legally called a conspiracy. So we look back, too, about the degree to which the origins of the national security state play into this. And as we've seen the expansion, I mean, just the FBI alone, in the mid-1930s, there was really only a couple 300 FBI agents operating in the United States. By 1945, there were 5,000. And we had no real intelligence services prior to World War II.
The OSS, the Office of Strategic Services.
That came
Navy.
With
yes.
World War II.
That's right.
That was part of the outspring of military intelligence. We had military intelligence before World War II, and we had the FBI. That was essentially it. So with OSS being developed during World War II, and then that leading to the Central Intelligence Agency.
And the National Security Administration, the NSA, thereafter.
1947, the Internal Security Act created that. But even then, there was 2,000 folks that worked for the CIA. By 1955, there were 15,000. And today, that number is actually classified. So
budget.
like their budget, right.
And connected to this rise of the national security state, that brings us to some clips we want to share from our 50th anniversary programming that we did about the assassination of President John Kennedy. We sat down, and instead of just blindly believing the Warren Commission report, which has been debunked even by the U.S. Congress pretty much, that said that there was a 95% possibility of a conspiracy afoot that it involved more than Lee Harvey Oswald, we're going to share with you several clips from that show to, again, show the point that there's a lot going on factually beneath the surface. And knowing what we know about the surveillance state and knowing what we know, of course, since Edward Snowden, but even going back and looking at this history from the OSS to the CIA and the NSA, there was a lot behind what was happening with the JFK assassination. And we're going to play for you several clips here from our 50th anniversary special. The first of these is Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick, co-authors of The Untold History of the United States. Kuznick is a history professor at American University. Stone, of course, a well-known producer of movies, including JFK, the 1991 epic that helped re-energize discussion about the assassination, actually led to a Presidential Records Act that demanded the declassification of the JFK files. And of course, as you'll hear in our clip here, we're going to talk to Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick. We'll also have attorney Mark Lane, Peter Dale Scott, and we'll also hear from Jefferson Morley, who is still trying to get those documents declassified. So here's a clip of Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick surrounding the JFK 50th anniversary.
If Edward Snowden had not existed, and I had come along and made a movie and said that the government is listening in on all your phone calls and has a record of everything, and because they're looking for a needle in a haystack, I mean, I would have been called nuts. And it, you know, thank God there was a Snowden to back it up. Ellsberg says something like that too. But you know, Jim Garrison was like Ellsberg, and he was like Snowden, but he was an anti-hero because he was misunderstood. His trial doesn't look so bad now. Yeah, he had a lot of difficulties, but he was trying to bring accusations in the light of day about covert operations of the United States government. And it was very difficult with the press against him and the leaks, the stealing and all this, to get his thinking across. But what he was saying, essentially, if you go back and read what he said, is essentially true about Kennedy, that he was killed for a motive. The motive was that he was a peacekeeper at a wrong time in this world when we wanted, basically, and I think we go into this in Untold History, we had such superiority militarily over the Soviet Union that many people, many serious people in this country in 1960, 61, by then, were really looking to fight a war with the Soviet Union because we thought we could win it, destroy them, and at the same time not suffer enough retaliation to worry us, which was sort of the scenario of Dr. Strangelove. These guys were ready to go to war. Kennedy was the one guy who said no at a key time.
More than once in the film, you used the word coup d'etat, or there was a coup with the assassination of Kennedy. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Actually, you have Garrison use the word fascism.
None of which I could back down from. I would support that theory. Is Peter on this phone call?
Yeah, Oliver, hi. I'm letting you do
I haven't
talk.
Heard a word out of you.
Peter Kuznick okay, also joins us.
Well, I'll weigh in on a couple of things.
But as to a coup d'etat, yes, a coup d'etat means that you have to have someone in place to take over who's going to not prosecute you for what you did. I think that's a pretty clear definition of what Johnson did. Whether he knew something in advance or not remains to be proven, but certainly by appointing Alan Dulles, the head of the Warren Commission, you have a perfect coup d'etat, which means you never get prosecuted for it. As to fascism, that's a very interesting word. It implies where I think our country is coming to today, where we have this gigantic nexus between government and corporations that control the country and the so-called free press. Go ahead, Peter.
The Washington Post did a number of public opinion polls about the Kennedy assassination, and during the Garrison investigation, 66% of the public believed that there was a conspiracy, that Oswald didn't act alone. And even in May of 1991, only 19% thought that Oswald acted alone in Washington Post polls. So Oliver was out there most prominently, but he certainly wasn't out there on his own in this kind of stuff.
That's filmmaker Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick speaking to us last November about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy. Another of our guests last November was Mark Lane. He's been investigating and writing about JFK assassination since it happened 50 years ago. He's the author of books Rush to Judgment, Plausible Denial, and Last Word. He was one of the first public critics of the Warren Commission report, which concluded Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy, and then Oswald acted alone. Here's part of our interview with Mark Lane, who clearly disagrees with the Warren Commission report and talks about CIA involvement in many of his works. Here's Mark Lane.
Mark, welcome.
Hi, how are you doing today?
We're doing just fine. We want you to tell your story, 50 years now, how you got involved originally writing Rush to Judgment, and you were talking about the Warren Commission problems early on. You were literally the first person really to get notoriety around this, and you took a lot of heat. So tell us what happened.
Well, yeah, that was the first one. If you look at the New York Times, just a couple of days after the Warren Report came out, you'll see I am the only person they could find who said there are problems about this, or there might be problems about this. So that was on the front page of the New York Times as the only person they could find. We had about 200 million people living in America then, and they couldn't find anybody else who thought there was a problem. I couldn't understand why everyone didn't think that this was a matter that had to be looked at very carefully. This was not a back alley killing of some unknown person. This was the President of the United States with the greatest protection one could imagine, Secret Service all over the place providing protection, and he was shot down in the middle of America on a bright sunny day with people watching it taking place. And it just seemed to me that there were a lot of questions and that they should be answered. And J. Lee Rankin, who became counsel to the general counsel to the Warren Commission, after we had made all of these complaints to the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, appointed a commission to look into what had taken place, and it was heard by the then Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren. It was politically chosen, two Democrats, two Republicans, one member of the Senate, one member of the House, et cetera. It was just a political operation, and they said it was well-balanced. It wasn't well-balanced, but that's a side point. It should not have been a political commission. It should have been a commission made up of historians, investigators, people who knew what they were doing. They had the Chief Justice as the chairman. He attended almost no hearings. I'm the only person in America who testified twice before the Warren Commission. The major problem was that they never investigated the facts, and they never intended to, because J. Lee Rankin, the general counsel, had said from the very beginning, our job is to reassure the American people. Well, that should not have been their job. Their job should have been to get the facts and tell us the facts.
We also had the opportunity to speak with Peter Dale Scott, professor emeritus at UC Berkeley, prolific author. He wrote Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, among other books. And this is an excerpt from our conversation with Peter Dale Scott, where he spoke about some of the powerful enemies Kennedy had made, and he connects it in many ways to the deep state and deep politics.
So in the context of John F. Kennedy and people who didn't like his administration, so to speak, and this wasn't just Catholic and political.
Oh, he had enemies. Yes, he certainly did.
He certainly
did.
Had some serious enemies.
Yes.
Dulles, of course, who he fired, or the CIA.
That's a big one. Alan Dulles.
Alan Dulles.
John Dulles was dead.
Alan Dulles. So not only was the CIA unhappy, the Cubans, the right-wing Cubans, the ones at the Bay of Pigs, were very unhappy.
Right.
And Kennedy felt he had been lied to about the Bay of Pigs, and that's why he didn't trust the CIA. And Robert of the Justice Department was going after the organized crime in many ways.
Yes.
Including Hoffa.
And there's an overlap there, too, because a lot of the people who came out of Cuba were organized crime figures. The biggest American presence in Havana before had been the casinos. Very much the same. The
and
word
Jack,
of Jack,
Jack Ruby.
Ruby
had been down there doing bag money work, correct?
Yeah, three times in 1959 after Castro came to power, Jack Ruby flew to Cuba. He said, as a tourist, he said, three times in 1 year? No, he went out to Trescornia prison where Santo Trafficante was interned. He seems to have met Trafficante. He had a very close friend, Louis McWillie, who was in charge of one of the casinos there, and then came back and was at the Cal Neva right up here on Lake Tahoe, which where Sam Giancana had an interest. So Jack Ruby was part of that world and a functioning part because, yes, I think that's what the House Committee on Assassinations concluded, that he was probably getting cash out each time he went in there because they were stuck with an awful lot of cash in Cuba, which they couldn't reach.
What reminds me that a lot of people don't remember that the House Committee on Assassinations did come to the conclusion that the John F. Kennedy killing was, in fact, a conspiracy.
A 95% probability of a conspiracy, they
said. Well, that's pretty high.
Yeah, it's high.
Right. Of course, the Warren Commission didn't go there.
Not at all.
And and what did the Warren Commission ignore? I mean, certainly Jack Ruby's crime connections was one of them.
That's the first thing you have to say. They completely ignored, and it's so pathetic when you look at the reasons. You know, I'll give credit to the commission that they published 26 volumes of hearings and evidence. So when they said Jack Ruby was not crime-connected, they're quoting somebody, and then when you look up in the footnotes to find who said it, it was, I think, Accardo, one of the heads of organized crime in Chicago. The FBI went to organized crime to ask the question, is he one of your guys? And they said, no. The FBI said, great. And they put it in a memo, and the Warren Commission published it as fact.
Another of our interviews from last November was the assassination researcher Jefferson Morley. He's the moderator of the website jfkfacts.org, former Washington Post reporter. He spoke to us about what he called a hidden history, or the untold history, surrounding the assassination of JFK and about the information which has still not been declassified. Here's a clip from Jefferson Morley.
There was the public history of the Kennedy assassination that we were given in the Warren Commission report in the 60s and in the congressional investigations of the 70s. But beneath that, there was a hidden history of how people closest to the crime and to the government reaction to it responded. And now, finally, after 50 years, we're really getting down to that hidden history and beginning to really understand what happened after President Kennedy was killed, before and after President Kennedy was killed.
Jefferson Morley, hi, this is Peter Phillips.
Hi, Peter.
The JFK denial in terms of media in the U.S., talk a little bit about that.
In my experience at the Washington Post, and I don't single out the Post, I think that mainstream news organizations, people in the government are uncomfortable talking about the JFK story in kind of candid and objective ways. From the beginning, there has been an impulse to justify the government's response, to rationalize it, to say that it's correct, and to say, to present a reassuring story to people that we know what happened and don't worry about it. And at the time when President Kennedy was killed, part of that impulse was to possibly prevent a war, a nuclear war, that people feared might result from the assassination of the president by a communist. And then over time, the rationalization sunk in that, you know, the media's done its job here. The government's done its job. These are honorable men in the Warren Commission, you know. And so this impulse to present a reassuring picture of the Kennedy assassination is still with us. And it still has a grip on about a third of the public. But most people don't believe that we have the whole story. Most polls show that about two-thirds of people think that the President Kennedy was killed by perpetrators who have never been identified. So I think that among news organizations, it's very difficult for them to revisit this subject with an open mind at this point. And I think that's really too bad, because I think that there is a terrific, important story there in the hidden history of the Kennedy assassination. And when it comes out, I think we're going to understand how our government works a lot more clearly, and we're going to understand our history better. I don't think we have anything to fear from that. I think that can only be good to really delve into this story. So without prejudging the results, I say, let's get the whole story. And even if you don't agree with me and you say we do have the whole story, then there shouldn't be any problem agreeing that whatever secret documents the government has now should be made public. On that, everybody can agree. And so my lawsuit and my journalism at jfkfacts.org is really directed at, let's have full disclosure, finally. 50 years is enough.
That was the voice of researcher Jefferson Morley, jfkfacts.org. And again, we're talking about this in the context here today. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're talking about it in the context of state crimes against democracy in the United States, from the JFK assassinations and COINTELPRO to 9/11 and beyond. And we're talking about the reality of many of the things that happen and how they happen in our society. And we before we played these JFK clips, Peter and I were talking about the rise of the national security state and the CIA and the NSA and surveillance and so forth. And Peter, talk to us a little bit about this audio documentary that we're going to play a few clips from that people could maybe find and listen to. This is called Me and My Shadow. Peter, talk to us about
this. Well, we selected this, I think, primarily because Catherine Olmsted, Real Enemies book author, she describes how the secret actions of government are the real enemies of democracy. And that plays right into Lance DeHaven Smith's book on conspiracy theories in America, where he calls state crimes against democracy actions in that regard. So me and my shadow, it's how the FBI and National Security State was following people. Talks about the COINTELPRO program, investigation of political left by the United States government. This was originally recorded in 1989.
We're going to play a couple clips now from Me and My Shadow. These excerpts include remarks of Ron Dellums, then a congressman representing Oakland, when he learned what the FBI had been up to.
Ron Dellums, a congressman from California and member of the House Select Committee to investigate the intelligence community, has publicly questioned the legitimacy of FBI activity in this area.
I'm sure at one time that that Berkeley had more agents in Berkeley than we probably had agents in Moscow. Because of the sick mentality in this country of who is the enemy. The enemy is anybody who opposes the policies of the administration, and we use the forces, have used the forces, and I think the documentation is clearly there, the FBI, the CIA, and other agencies to harass, intimidate, infiltrate, perhaps even assassinate, kidnap, and engage in many, many other insane and very cruel acts.
I grew up thinking that the FBI and the police were the good guys, that their job was to protect me and mine.
The informer is a key factor in the development of files. That is, the way in which informers' reports are processed by agents on an individual, organizational, and incident level so as to strengthen the file system. And of course, the file system is extremely important because it's used to support the intelligence thesis that social unrest is produced by individual conspiratorial bad men, cunning and ruthless. It's an attempt to individuate what are fundamentally social problems.
Mary Jo Cook infiltrated the Buffalo, New York chapter of Vietnam Veterans Against the War Winter Soldier Organization.
One of the things that I was very worried about after watching the Watergate testimony was the security of the information that I was passing, because I had passed so much information. I wanted to know whether or not the people that I informed on would be hurt through that. And I respected those people, and I was very concerned. I wanted to know how much of the information was being sent to Washington, who was going to use it, how it was going to be used. And the answers that I got were not satisfactory. I'd worked for them in what I felt to be an honest capacity, and I'd learned through a whole process of working for them that I could not trust them, that even if they felt they were being honest, that they were lying to themselves a lot, and that they were not being responsible as members of a law enforcement agency, that they were helping to set up their apparatus for 1984, and they didn't even care.
Ralph Stein can guess how much of this information reached Washington. In 1967 and 68, he headed a new left desk for Army intelligence. In that capacity, he processed informers' reports and exchanged files with the FBI and other government agencies.
Some of the information which we received, which is so intensely personal and so violative of virtually any definition of First Amendment rights, that at the time we all began to realize, most of us did anyway, that we were really acquiring the apparatus of a police state.
The First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble.
Some of the information about FBI activities was brought to light by informants who later told the public what they'd been doing for the Bureau. Here's another excerpt from Me and My Shadow.
Much of what we now know about FBI infiltration comes from the confessions of former informants and career agents. Internal FBI memoranda provide another source of information. In 1971, files were stolen from the Bureau's office in Media, Pennsylvania, by a group calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI. Information contained in those files has enabled other investigators to obtain more documents by suing the Bureau under the Freedom of Information Act. The heavily censored documents turned over by the FBI as a result of those suits revealed the existence of extensive domestic counterintelligence programs, called COINTELPROs, They used legal and illegal methods to infiltrate, disrupt, and harass politically active citizens.
Congressman Ron Dellums reads from one of these documents.
Counterintelligence program, internal security, disruption of the new left. Our nation is undergoing an era of disruption and violence caused to a large extent by various individuals generally connected with the new left. Some of these activities urge revolution in America and call for the defeat of the United States in Vietnam. They continually and falsely allege police brutality and do not hesitate to utilize unlawful acts to further their so-called causes. The new left has on many occasions viciously and scurrilously attacked the director of the FBI in an attempt to hamper our investigation of it and to drive us off the college campus. With this in mind, it is our recommendation that a new counterintelligence program be designed to neutralize the new left and the key activists. The key activists are those individuals who are the moving forces behind the new left and on whom we have intensified our investigation, the new left. I think when you get into those kind of labels, there's awesome potential to abuse people. And so you take this kind of statement and you move against any organization that any informant or any agent or any person out there says is a new left group, you automatically says that equals danger, that equals violence, and then you justify a massive program to infiltrate these organizations. Now, what is the role of the government to do this?
Legislative committees have tried to answer that question. In September 1975, Senator Frank Church questioned the former chief of the FBI's Domestic Intelligence Division about former FBI Director Hoover's approval of the large-scale investigation of American college students.
Can you clarify for me which techniques that you're stating the director approved, which would have been illegal?
Well, there were a number of activities included. B of these activities was opening cases on approximately 4,000 black student activists, all members of the black student unions and similar groups, regardless of their past or present involvement in disorders. And it involved the opening cases on approximately 6,500 new left student activists, black and white, to determine whether they have a propensity for violence. Now, how do you investigate a person to find out whether he has a propensity for violence?
How do you investigate a propensity for violence? The FBI's answer is to flood targeted groups with informers who often act as provocateurs.
First agent I ever knew was in SDS, and he was a provocateur. So I didn't trust him, work with him. I thought he was crazy. And so did almost everybody else in the SDS chapter. He was just someone who was just always running his mouth off about, you know, we would want to demonstrate someplace and he'd want to blow it up, only he wanted to blow up a dorm.
David Sanis worked for the FBI in the Seattle area.
If anybody seemed interested in violent solutions, I was out advocating, telling him how to do it, and hoping to get people to want to become involved in it.
We just heard excerpts from Me and My Shadow, a 1989 audio documentary from Pacifica Archives about federal surveillance and other actions against the left and anti-war movements during the 1960s and 70s. This is a one-hour documentary. You can find it through the Pacifica Archives. But again, we could be talking today. I mean, this was done in 1989, and now, particularly after the Edward Snowden revelations, it's interesting to note in the earlier clip we played from Oliver Stone, you know, he said that, well, if I had said years ago that we were being spied upon and all of our transactions and communications and so on were being collected by the federal government, people would have said I was a conspiracy theorist in a pejorative way. They would have said I was nuts. But it's true. This is in fact happened. These things have come to pass. And we know COINTELPRO didn't get put to bed, even though we had the, you know, Media Pennsylvania files that exposed COINTELPRO and the Frank Church Committee in the 1970s. They talked about how the COINTELPRO ended. But the policies and the actions of COINTELPRO continued. You know, one of the most notable in recent history, given that we were giving a talk recently in Fresno, was meeting with one of the Women in Peace Fresno. And she talked about and reminded us of how that group was infiltrated during the W. Bush years and the war against Iraq and the so-called war on terrorism, that the Department of Homeland Security was infiltrating these peace groups and promoting violence and these types of actions. So, you know, this is still very much with us, this kind of surveillance mentality. And it's not a conspiratorial paranoid mindset that notices them necessarily. It's simply looking at the empirical evidence and what it strongly suggests about the type of society we live in the United States.
Certainly one of the biggest conspiracy groups was the John Birch Society, starting right back after World War II, where they believed that a vast communist conspiracy was involved in the government, taking over America, putting fluoride in our water, And, you know, fluoride itself, there's health reasons for that one, but there certainly wasn't a communist conspiracy going back. That, leads right up to, as the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union, new enemies emerged. We called them terrorists. And they were, in fact, the conspiracy theory is that 19 terrorists stole airplanes and drove them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. That is a conspiracy theory, quite clearly.
We at Project Censored helped put together an all-day 10th anniversary special for Pacifica Radio. It was the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Project Censored specifically put together some debates. One of the debates was, of course, about what happened in New York City and the Twin Towers and Building 7. But the other one was a debate that Peter and I moderated that involved the 9/11 Commission report and problems with the 9/11 Commission report, omissions, distortions, inconsistencies. And, those are very relevant to this very day, and we keep finding out more and more about some of the involvement of people and what was covered up. And we want to play for you a couple clips from the discussion that we had for the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
With us in studio is Todd Fletcher. He's a researcher for David Ray Griffin and has written parts of the 9 books that David Ray Griffin has been involved with. He's a member of the 9/11 Consensus Council and a co-producer of Guns and Butter, a weekly radio program on Pacifica Station. Also on the line with us is Jonathan Kay. He's managing editor of Canada's National Post newspaper. Thank you very much. So, Jonathan, you're up first. You have 3 minutes to do an introductory statement.
Thank you. I'm here to defend the official theory of 9/11, which is that the 9/11 attacks and the damage they caused were the work of Al-Qaeda terrorists who hijacked commercial airliners and smashed them into the Twin Towers and Pentagon. In making the case, I will emphasize the conclusions of others, namely the 9/11 Commission report, the detailed reports from the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and journalistic investigations too numerous to mention. All of these reputable sources, I will argue, which collectively draw on the work of thousands of scientists and engineers in government, academia, and private practice, all support the official view of 9/11. In particular, they support the view that the destruction of the Twin Towers, which in my experience is the main obsession of many conspiracy theorists, was caused by the crash of airliners into the upper floors, the ignition of dozens of tons of airplane fuel, the weakening of load-bearing steel columns due to fire, the deformation of critical floor trusses, and the consequent catastrophic collapse of the structures. Members of the 9/11 truth movement, as it is called, say they are open-minded skeptics who are simply asking questions. But in the years I spent writing my recently published book about 9/11 conspiracy theories, I found that almost all of these activists have already made up their mind. In particular, they believe that World Trade Center buildings 1, 2, and 7 were brought down through controlled internal demolition, and that the masterminds of this demolition plot were elements within the Bush administration seeking a pretext to attack Iraq and Afghanistan. This conspiracy theory has been debunked many times over during the last decade, but 9/11 truthers still cling to various talking points, which generally consist of misleading scientific factoids and stray quotations from public figures taken out of context. And I imagine that during this debate, we will set about discussing some of these details. But one does not have to debate these fine points to understand how far-fetched the conspiracy theorists' views truly are. All one has to do is ask the following question. Do you really think it is possible that a secret army consisting of thousands of spies and demolitions engineers could really spend months planting thousands of bombs around some of the busiest office buildings in the world without someone noticing? And even if they were successful in this Hollywood-style plot, do you really imagine that no one from this army of thousands of evildoers would come forward to tell the truth despite the passage of a full decade? Now, conspiracy theorists claim the mainstream media won't tell the truth about 9/11 because we are on orders not to from our corporate puppet masters. But in fact, just about every journalist I know, including me, would love nothing more than to become rich and famous by unmasking a conspiracy that, if true, would be the story of the century. But in fact, these conspiracy theories are not true.
Next, we have Todd Fletcher. Todd?
The subject of the debate today is the veracity of the 9/11 Commission report. And so we are today supposed to be talking about the 9/11 Commission report's version of the events. I'd like to just say a few general things about the report. There are two major reasons to doubt its veracity. One is conflicts of interest in the personnel who ran the commission, and the other is that the report contains lies, implicit and explicit lies, lies of either omission or distortion. The principal and controlling conflict of interest was the close association of the executive director of the commission, Philip Zelikow, with the White House. He was a two-time Bush administration insider. He worked on George H.W. Bush's National Security Council with Condoleezza Rice. He co-wrote a book with Rice during the Clinton years when they were out of office. Rice brought him onto the National Security Council transition team when there was the transition from Clinton to George W. Bush. And then George W. Bush named him to the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. In 2002, Rice picked him to write the 2002 National Security Strategy of the United States, which, for the first time in history, asserted as official U.S. policy preemptive war, subsequently known as the Bush Doctrine, when it was invoked to justify the illegal invasion of Iraq. Zelikow based his argument for the doctrine of preemptive war on the 9/11 attacks. They were the pretext he used for this massive change in U.S. policy to justify wars of aggression. As has been described in New York Times reporter Philip Shannon's book, The Commission, Zelikow controlled the commission virtually completely. He wrote an outline of the entire report, complete with chapter headings, subheadings, and sub-subheadings, before the investigation even began. He kept the existence of his outline a secret, with the collusion of Commission Chair Thomas Kane and Vice Chair Lee Hamilton. The staff of the commission did not find out about the outline until a year later, and some members of the staff compared the commission report to the Warren Commission report on the JFK assassination, that famous cover-up, as a result. Finally, Zelikow rewrote all drafts submitted by the research teams. The report Zelikow produced contains many lies of omission, implicit lies, of important facts relevant to a full understanding of the 9/11 attacks. The only sense in which the report is a full account, as it was mandated to be, is that it included everything that supported the official conspiracy theory, that the attacks were a surprise carried out by Al-Qaeda. But almost all facts, which suggest otherwise, were either omitted or distorted by the report.
You just heard clips from the 10th anniversary of 9/11, the special that Project Censored helped put together for Pacifica Radio. You can learn more online at projectcensored.org or the Pacifica site. But I wanted to say that, again, our focus here today has been looking at actual fact-based problems with very controversial events. And we call these state crimes against democracy because the term conspiracy theorist has been so sullied in our society in a way that it dismisses these types of important investigations. So when we say state crimes against democracy, we want to really unearth factual conspiracies and crimes and so forth. We're not interested in the wanton speculation, in the what-ifs per se. We're interested in actually trying to find out what has gone on. And we have mentioned previously here Lance DeHaven-Smith's book, Conspiracy Theory in America, Catherine Olmsted's book, Real Enemies, Conspiracy Theories and American Democracy from World War I to 9/11. In Censored 2014, our latest book, there's a chapter called Diffusing Conspiracy Panics on the Public Use of Reason in the 21st Century Truth Emergency. And what we need to remember is Emma Goldman reminds us that the most unpardonable sin in society is independence of thought. And we're really trying to get to that in this. And in that chapter, by the way, in the book, really tries to look at the problems that arise, the controversies that surround just even discussing these things, Peter. So today's program, we're really dedicating to the important research that independent journalists and so forth do on these important topics.
If we look back historically, people in the United States at the time of the Revolution believed that King George was plotting against this country to control us and to profit from us. We had a different President George, who was telling us that weapons of mass destruction existed in Iraq and that we had to go to war there. So when these types of lies, these types of misinformation occur, these are what are often labeled as conspiracy theories, really are state crimes against democracy. And secret plots of powerful people do happen. And we have plenty of proven evidences of that. And certainly weapons of mass destruction is one. So it's very important to look at the study of state crimes. It's a study of conspiracy theories. These are not just understandings of based on mental illness and personality problems, of paranoia, but there's some real historical facts involved in these issues.
That's right, Peter. And again, today's program, we were looking at important state crimes against democracy in the United States, from the JFK assassinations and COINTELPRO to 9/11 and beyond. We played several clips from some of our previous shows, the JFK assassination shows, the 9/11 programs. We also played the audio clips from Me and My Shadow about the surveillance state. And again, you know, that's something that's going on right now in the revelations of Edward Snowden and others. We continue to live under the great panopticon and surveillance state. And again, these are very real conspiracies that, again, if you'd said that years ago, you would have been seen as a crazy person. But rather than be crazy people for noticing, maybe we're calling attention to some of the more instable or crazy parts of our alleged democracy. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show here on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Our program originates out of KPFA Studios in Berkeley, California. For archives of our shows, visit projectcensored.org, and please keep tabs and like us on Facebook at Project Censored. Special thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer. Thanks for joining us. We will see you next time.